Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast, where we have three fellas who are happy to talk all things Canadian football. Aren't we, John Hodge and JC Abbott?
Of course. We're living the dream. Any day you get paid to come online, talk some Canadian football. Who could have a frown on an occasion like this?
Even when there's topics we don't like, we always have a smile on our face.
Yes, indeed.
Sometimes we get outvoted, but that's just part of life, right? It's what makes the trio better than two people, because if we're just agreeing all the time or having one vote on one side and one vote on the other side, that wouldn't be any fun. We need a tiebreaker.
Exactly. And this is why I'm petitioning to get a second wife. My first one, not super into it. Yeah, that was a joke, by the way. I don't want a second wife. But she doesn't watch the podcast, so I can make jokes like that.
Yeah, nobody said that clip to Hodge's wife.
No, I don't want a second wife. I love my wife. She's the love of my life. We've been together for a very, very long time. So that's why I can make jokes like that.
Happy wife, happy life. I wouldn't know anything about that.
Happy house. That's the way to go. Happy spouse, happy house.
I dig it. Let's get into the topics we're chopping up today, fellas. The Saskatchewan Roughriders hiring Andrew Harris. What in the what? As the team's running backs coach? Goodness me.
Renovations coming to Ottawa's football stadium.
The CFLPA strongly opposing the recent Luches Purifoy suspension.
Danny Machocha stating Sean Lemon should be reinstated following his year-long gambling suspension.
And the CFL unveiling some key off-season dates. But first,
the Saskatchewan Roughriders hired legendary CFLer Andrew Harris as the team's running backs coach. Harris spent 2 years in Toronto when Corey Mace was the team's defensive coordinator and played two seasons alongside A.J. Ouellette, winning a Grey Cup in 2022. Is this a smart hire, and can Harris get Ouellette back to his dominant ways?
Yes, I do think it's a smart hire, and I do think also that Harris can help Ouellette get back to his 1,000-yard ways, because that's the number almost exactly that Ouellette ran for in his last season with the Argos when he was with Harris. The two are clearly good friends, so good that Andrew Harris made a trip to Hamilton last year and put on the green and white. Actually, I'm pretty sure it was actually the Obsidian jersey, but anyways, put on Riders colors to support Ouellette at that game. Took a picture with Ouellette after the game. Shout out our cameraman there in the Hammer, Bob Buttram, for that unique picture that we've been using since this coaching decision was announced. So I do think that Harris can help. And it's interesting to me that not in title, but he's going to be learning the football operations and, should I say, player evaluation side as well. He told me that Jeremy O'Day has given him a list of Canadian running backs eligible in the 2025 CFL draft to evaluate. So not only is he the running backs coach, he is starting to get into personnel. And he said flat out that his goal is to one day at some point in time work towards being either a head coach or general manager. There are some guys in the past and right now in the league that have both roles. Dave Dickinson currently with the Calgary Stampeders. So I think that's a fair statement for Harris to make, because you have to have goals in life. He knows this is the first step. He's not being arrogant about it. I think he's just being honest in terms of what his goals are. But there was one quote, guys, that stuck out to me, because there was a lot of people, Hodge, I'm sure you heard the noise, that were talking about this and saying, well, you know, why isn't he the running backs coach in Winnipeg? I'll let you speak to that in a minute. But here was his quote on that. Ability is nothing without opportunity. There, the Saskatchewan Roughriders, the ones who gave me the opportunity. I'm going to do what I can to make sure I'm giving the backs, the offense, the run game, the O-line, the whole team the best I can to make an impact. So I'm ultra curious. Hopefully one day we find out what happened behind the scenes to understand why Andrew Harris is perhaps not with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers and now putting on the colors of his hated rival from his days with the blue and gold.
Corey Mace was asked via video conference from the CFL's recent off-season winter meetings in Charlotte, North Carolina, why AJ Ouellette struggled this past season. And let's not shy away from it. He had a terrible season last year. He got paid $160,000, which is a lot of money for an American running back. He's on pace to make $170,000 this year. Again, a lot of money for an American running back. He had 4.2 yards per carry this past year. That was 1.5 yards less than he had the previous season and was almost a full yard worse than the previous low that he had in his career. For the record, fellas, that was the second worst mark in the CFL among all running backs, and it was the worst mark of any running back with at least 100 carries. So AJ Ouellette has to bounce back. Mace said, well, the challenge with AJ Ouellette is he's squatting 700 pounds in season. And so for that reason, I think Andrew Harris is the perfect hire, because if you can have anybody pulling people out of the gym, it's Andrew Harris, a guy who, by his own admission, almost never lifted during the season ever, right? The Bombers have a checklist outside of their weight room where every time you do a lift, you do a little check. And Andrew Harris has openly said, yeah, basically my whole career there, I was at or very near the bottom of that list come the end of the year. Ironically, or coincidentally, the guy who has been at the very top of that list the last few years is Brady Oliveira. So benching and squatting and lifting crazy amount of weight appears to be benefiting Brady Oliveira. I don't know why it's inhibiting AJ Ouellette at this stage of his career. It might just be because he's a little bit older. As for the coaching issue in Winnipeg, Jason Hogan is extremely tight with Brady Oliveira. Brady Oliveira, when he was named MOP, thanked Jason Hogan in his speech, I think, 3 different times. So I don't think the job was open in Winnipeg. That being said, interesting that Mike O'Shea apparently did not even respond to Andrew Harris's messages. Now, should be noted that Andrew Harris, in his last season in Winnipeg in 2021, came back from the pandemic out of shape, and as he discussed in his documentary Running Back Relentless, was dealing with some substance issues during that time. So his mind was maybe not 100% in on football. I don't know if O'Shea is still holding that against him to some extent. O'Shea has not had the opportunity to comment on this, and knowing Mike O'Shea, I doubt that he will comment anything of substance on this issue, though I'm looking forward to getting the opportunity to ask him. So that's kind of my take. I think this is a great hire for the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. I'm sure there were lots of Rider fans on Monday when this news came out, scrubbing their Twitter feeds of all kinds of horrible things they'd written about Andrew Harris after he tested positive for PEDs, after he threw, I forget, you guys remember in the Banjo Bowl a few years ago who he threw to the ground? There was, he grabbed somebody by the helmet. I can't remember who it was, but that was
a DB.
It was a DB. It happened right in front of the press box. I can see it in my mind's eye, but I don't remember the name of the player. So I don't want to sit here and guess who it was. But there are, point is, I get why Rider fans do not like Andrew Harris. But I think they will like him if he's able to turn AJ Ouellette's career back around.
And I think that's the key part of this. You mentioned the weight room element sort of as a joke, Hodge. I had the exact same thought, but I think there's a grain of truth to it. Andrew Harris was able to keep performing at a very high level as he got into his early 30s. That's what AJ Ouellette is now trying to figure out how to do. And I think having a guy that you have a rapport with, somebody who can tell it to you straight, who you respect as a player and as a person, being able to be in your ear and guide you through that process can be invaluable. Occasionally, there's nothing wrong with having coaches that don't have a ton of playing experience or haven't gone through things. Good players aren't always good coaches, but sometimes when you're a guy who's going through something that very few guys have had the opportunity to go through, like being a 30-year-old running back trying to regain your form in professional football, it helps to have someone to lean on who's done it before. And let's be frank, guys. I got a lot of pushback from Rider fans on my article when I wrote about the Riders' comments saying they're not going to cut AJ Ouellette. He's in the plans going forward. And a lot of people saying, Why is somebody writing this article? It's ridiculous. Why would anyone even consider that? Well, to Hodge's earlier point, AJ Ouellette, yes, he was battling injury, but he was terrible last season. He is 30 years old, and he is getting paid $170,000 next season, which is ridiculous money for an American running back when so many teams are able to find guys off the street on rookie minimum deals that could be productive. I think it's a fair question to ask about AJ Ouellette's status going forward. The Riders have made clear that they're going to bet on him, but now they are backing up that bet by giving him the resources he needs to be successful.
That banjo bowl brawl, some alliteration there, with Andrew Harris included him shoving Micah Johnson, and then he grabbed Christian Campbell's face mask, swung him down to the ground, and eventually pulled his helmet off. So, I mean, Harris did talk about the rivalry there and that it's football and you got to be a professional and put that behind you here. And, you know, ultimately, reading the tea leaves, it didn't seem like there was this similar opportunity with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. Not sure if that was because of Mike O'Shea or whatever. We'll leave that to O'Shea when he has a chance to potentially talk about this, because we don't even know if he'll go into detail. He didn't even want to talk about why he was on the Toronto Maple Leafs mentors trip, but that's a conversation for another day. So I don't think he's really going to get into it.
It's my private life, damn it. This is my when I decide to attend a public event with the most popular sports team in Canada, that should remain private. Okay. You're entitled to your opinion, sir.
That's a good thing, too.
It's a great thing that he got to do. I wish he had told us about it.
So Harris is taking the opportunity that's in front of him, and I am very curious to see where this goes on multiple fronts, because it's not always as easy as being a great player and then turning into a great coach. We've seen that a number of times. You know, people have talked about Wayne Gretzky in that regard, but I think we can talk about that in the CFL in a number of examples where guys will talk about at the end of their career, yeah, they want to be a head coach or GM or get into coaching or talent evaluation, but it's not that easy. You got to grind and you have to change and become a teacher now, not a doer. I'm not saying guys can't do it. And there are examples of people out there, like, you know, I think of Ryan Phillips jumped to mind in BC. Anthony Calvillo is obviously with the Montreal Alouettes. So there are current players in the league that went from playing to coaching, but it's something that you're going to have to work at. And it seems like if we take Harris at his word, he's willing to do that.
One quick thing, or two very quick things before I move on. One, I just want to commend Andrew Harris on his confidence in pushing Micah Johnson. Like, that is something that I couldn't even imagine doing. And even most professional football players, like the thought of antagonizing Micah Johnson, like that man is twice the size of even most football players. Like he is powerful. Well,
not,
he is raw.
Height wise.
Well, he's not that tall, but you get what I'm saying. He's the strongest person on the field. Like, there's a reason why he was all CFL this past season at 36, which is crazy. It's also funny that they could now be on the same team if, of course, Micah Johnson re-ups with the Riders ahead of becoming a free agent next month. Other thing, and this is probably something the CFL should look at from a rule standpoint, a bunch of people were upset. I remember specifically from that game that Andrew Harris was not thrown out, because a punch is an automatic ejection. Ripping someone to the ground by their helmet is not an automatic ejection. And when you think about it, punching someone who is wearing a helmet is probably actually not very dangerous for the person wearing the helmet. You're probably more likely to hurt your hand as the puncher. You can seriously injure someone by grabbing their helmet and throwing them to the ground. So maybe that's something, I know it doesn't happen a lot, but that's probably something that should be addressed to the CFL rulebook. If somebody grabs a helmet and throws somebody else to the ground, they should probably not be in the game. Just a thought.
Hodge, you asked Ryan Dinwiddie about the possibility of him ever leaving for the NFL. Do you think it's realistic the 44-year-old could take a job south of the border at some point?
I do. Dinwiddie's previously been offered a job in the NFL. He was offered an offensive quality control position back in 2018 by Dirk Cutter. Now, Dirk Cutter was his college head coach. And as Dinwiddie spoke about at length, he got a number of questions or follow-ups after my initial question via video conference. And I thought answered them very candidly, like Ryan Dinwiddie, an open book on, I think, most issues, this one certainly being one of them, which is refreshing. It's admirable almost. He admitted that, yeah, like that was the connection. He did not want to take the job because he said he knew Cutter was going to get fired. And sure enough, him and his staff were fired 1 year later after going 5-11, his third season.
With the Tampa Bay Bucks.
With the Bucks. Yes, with the Bucks in 2019. That coaching staff only lasted one more year after Dinwiddie was offered the job. But at the end of the day, Dinwiddie, I do think, has garnered the respect of a lot of people south of the border. He said he does have a lot of connections. He did also bemoan that the NFL, and this is a quote, is a, quote, good old boy league, close quote. He also said, quote, you look at half the coaches in the league, their dads were coaches, and these guys got jobs at, like, 23, then their head coaches at 30, and they struggle, close quote. Now, I don't think it's true that most NFL coaches got hired at 23 and became head coaches at 30. I think he's being a little bit facetious there. But it is true that a lot of NFL coaches are the sons of coaches, or maybe through those types of connections got better opportunities either earlier than they otherwise would have, or maybe were able to ascend the ranks a little bit higher than they otherwise may have. But a key thing to watch here is the fact that Ryan Dinwiddie is still tight with his former Winnipeg Blue Bombers teammate, Cliff Kingsbury, who, of course, was Patrick Mahomes' collegiate coach at Texas Tech, then went on to a four-year stint as the head coach with the Arizona Cardinals. He is back in the news cycle because he is in his first year as the offensive coordinator of the Washington Commanders, where he has helped Jaden Daniels not only have a sensational rookie season, but help that team reach the NFC Championship game for the first time since 1991. So Ryan Dinwiddie, though he made it clear he has not had any NFL requests for interviews this offseason, is yet to draw any interest. It's also possible that Cliff Kingsbury is going to become an NFL head coach again this offseason once the Commanders are either eliminated from the playoffs or, dare I say, go to the Super Bowl and even win it. And I do think that whether it's for 2025 or beyond, could open the door for Dinwiddie to go down there. After all, he called the NFL life-changing money for his family. And also specified, he said, well, yeah, I think everybody at the end of the day wants to go to the NFL. So I do think it's a possibility for him. And again, I really appreciate the candidness with which he answered these questions.
Yeah, certainly nobody should begrudge Dinwiddie for having NFL aspirations or dreams. He's right. It is life-changing money. It's a different type of lifestyle entirely that you're able to secure for your family if you are able to have success south of the border. And I think CFL fans know it from supporting players, but anybody who wants to make that jump should have our full support in order to secure that bag. Is it realistic in the short term? I'm not convinced that it's going to happen anytime soon. Dinwiddie's resume certainly speaks to it, but currently, as you pointed out, Hodge, his best connection down there is Cliff Kingsbury. And my feeling is, if that was going to happen, if Cliff was going to bring Dinwiddie down and bring him onto his staff, then it would have happened the first time he was a head coach, right, with the Arizona Cardinals. Now he's had even more time in the NFL coaching ranks. He's built more relationships with existing
NFL coaches.
Well,
hold on. Why would
NFL
that have happened the first time? Dinwiddie had not won two Grey Cups as a head coach in the CFL.
Well, you're not bringing a guy in like Dinwiddie to an NFL coaching staff just because of his CFL resume. We're
not just because of it, but it helps the legitimacy of it. Instead of just hiring your buddy, you say, hey, he's won two out of the last three Grey Cups in the Canadian Football League. He knows what he's doing.
It certainly does. But when you look at the roles that he would be potentially hired for, those sort of offensive assistant, offensive analyst positions, and you look at the resumes of those type of guys, it's not exactly as if you need to be a world beater to have those type of positions, right? They're entry-level
positions. Who says he couldn't be an offensive coordinator?
I mean,
like, I get that we're speculating here, but you can't say that
Kingsbury
would have brought him in the first time, because now Ryan Dinwiddie has proven himself as a legitimate high-end CFL head coach, and we've seen what that's done for CFL coaches in the past, like Mark Trestman going from head coach of the Montreal Alouettes after winning Grey Cups to the head coach of the Chicago Bears. I just think it's a totally different discussion. You can't say, well, because he didn't do it the first time, he won't do it this time, because it's totally different now.
I actually disagree. I think the Mark Trestman comparison that gets drug out consistently is a false one, because before Mark Trestman was a Grey Cup winning CFL head coach, he was a very respected NFL offensive mind for a number of years.
And I'm not comparing him to Trestman. I'm saying that Trestman does not get that Chicago Bears head coach job if he doesn't win Grey Cups with the Montreal Alouettes and build arguably that dynasty there. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying he's going to go to be a head coach. I'm saying that it's a different conversation now, because owners on down can look at Ryan Dinwiddie and say, well, yeah, if we bring this guy in, you know, we're not going to get laughed at, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I think you are overestimating how much NFL folks care about CFL accomplishments. Do I think that Ryan Dinwiddie is deserving? Absolutely. I'm not questioning that. I just don't think that winning a whole bunch of Grey Cups is necessarily a feather in your cap in the NFL, particularly nowadays, compared to what it once was. Like, if that logic was true, every guy that had coached a Grey Cup championship team or two would be getting those type of looks, right? That doesn't happen.
I'm not saying you have to. I'm just saying it
is an outlier. And the other coaches that we've seen go down there in recent years, guys like Scott Milanovich, who would be, I think, a little bit of a better comparison, start out in those entry-level positions as a QB coach or as an offensive analyst, and then have to work their way up, right? I think that is more the comparable to what Dinwiddie's path would be, particularly at his current age. And I'm not certain that his relationship with Cliff Kingsbury, and I don't know, but what he made it sound like in the press conference is they text back and forth occasionally. But I don't know that that is strong enough to necessitate him being brought on at his next head coaching opportunity if it wasn't the first time around, when Kingsbury had far fewer actual NFL connections at the time.
I just think you can't compare it to the first time, with all due respect.
Let me jump in really quick. So Dinwiddie said, yes, he said Kingsbury has ghosted him on his last three texts. So he's like, yeah, he's big timing me, which was kind of a joke. And he speculated that, well, maybe he's got a new phone. But he did say, and this is a quote, I used to go down to Texas Tech all the time, and we talked and texted when he was at Arizona. So I don't know what going down to Texas Tech all the time means, but I think this relationship is much more than just we text each other Merry Christmas and try to remember each other's birthdays and then forget and then send the text like 2 weeks later, like, oh, sorry, I missed this. Also, JC, the past tense of drag is dragged, not drug. You have a degree from UBC. You should know that.
My degree is that being said, not English.
Yeah, but it's still a good school and you have a degree. So don't talk like a hillbilly. That being said, wow. I agree with what JC is saying. I think that the Grey Cup victories can help legitimize somebody to like a little bit of an extent, but there's a reason why Mike O'Shea, for instance, who has been to the last five Grey Cups, winning two and having won a bunch of stuff as a player, including like a number of Grey Cups, has never once gotten NFL buzz, right? And that's because of the
hold
end of
on,
the day.
Hold on,
I don't think the NFL
Mike
cares.
O'Shea won't even tell us the reason why he's on the mentor trip. Why would he ever even want it out there that people broach the NFL subject with him? Like, the easy connection for Mike O'Shea is like, don't you think, and we're speculating here, Mike O'Shea has ever had a conversation with Thomas Dimitroff, who he shares an alma mater with, who was a longtime general manager in the NFL, and asked him what it was about? Like, you'd have to think there was at least a conversation.
Dimitroff once floated that O'Shea should be a defensive coordinator in the NFL, which was a little bit eyebrow-raising, considering that Mike O'Shea has never been a defensive coordinator anywhere. So that was a little bit of an eyebrow raise. So but it's possible. And you're right, O'Shea would never leak it, but somebody else could leak it on the NFL side, or somebody else could find out through other circles, through Guelph circles. So I think that that stuff does still have a chance of being reported. But at the end of the day, I think that ultimately JC is right. I think Mark Trestman got the head coaching opportunity in Chicago.
I wasn't comparing him directly to Trestman.
I'm not
Y'all
saying
aren't
you,
listening.
Well, I'm not saying, okay, fair enough. But let's remember that Trestman had like 20 years of NFL experience and then came up to the CFL later. I think
that he was not getting that Chicago Bears head coach job if he did not win multiple Grey Cups and make the Alouettes into a dynasty. That wasn't happening. That was my point. Is that it lends credibility and legitimacy. Let's go back to what JC wants to talk about. Cliff Kingsbury, first-time head coach.
I disagree, though.
If he's going to say, hey, I'm going to reach and grab my guy from the Canadian Football League, who at that time was what, like a quarterback coach?
He was the quarterback coach, yes. Yes.
As a first-time head coach? Like, that's not going to happen. But now if you say, hey, this guy has won two Grey Cups. Yes, he's my friend, but he's high quality. We spent lots of time together. Like, there's more legitimacy to it. I understand what you're saying. JC is like, 1 + 1 doesn't always equal 2 in these things. And it's more about what Dinwiddie said, I think, in terms of the NFL being an old boys club. But don't get it twisted. I'm not saying Ryan Dinwiddie and Mark Trestman's situations are the same. This is relationship-based. It's an old boys club.
Yeah, and I agree with that, Doug. I just think for your point in terms of lending legitimacy and whatever, like every year when I go through and I have to make my list of Canadians and former CFLers in the NFL playoffs, I have to go through and read every single bio of every single member of the NFL staffs that are in the playoffs. So I go through and I have to read all the accomplishments of everybody on that coaching staff. And once you get even to the lower level assistant position coaches, you're talking about guys who played at D3 schools for a couple years and then got an internship, and that's why they're there. Like, it's not as if you have to be a super accomplished person to get your foot in the door with that type of gig, right? And you're talking about a guy who was already a quarterback's coach in the CFL, like had a tremendous career at Boise State. That is, I would argue, overqualified compared to some of the people who are currently assistant quarterback coaches or offensive analysts or whatever it may be, right? There's nothing stopping a guy like that from getting that job. I don't think that
I'm not saying it's stopping anybody. I'm just saying that it brings more legitimacy to it.
It does to an
extent. Marcus Brady is an example, sort of what you're talking about. But I think in this case, to bring a little bit more focus to it, Ryan Dinwiddie clearly is not leaving for an offensive quality control position, especially if he feels like the staff is in danger of getting fired. If Kingsbury were to get hired and gets, like, let's say, for example, a 5-year contract, and he's going to go there and be potentially on the offensive staff and get a multi-year deal in a position like quarterback's coach or offensive coordinator or something that he feels is not just going to go away in a year, then I think that's kind of what we're talking about. Like, I just don't want to get what I'm saying twisted in a sense, because your point is well taken that there are career coaches on staffs that haven't risen to the highest level yet in the NFL, or possibly a bunch of them have never even done that at any other professional football level, or maybe even not the NCAA.
I think we're going around in circles a little bit. I agree with Justin that the Grey Cups matter to at least a little bit of an extent. I do want to give one slight correction. Dirk Koetter had already been the head coach in Tampa Bay for 2 years before he offered Dinwiddie the job. So he wasn't just totally, you know, fresh in Tampa. He'd already been in Northern Florida for a couple of years. I do, however, want to highlight this quote from Nathan Rourke, which was given on October 16th, or at least was reported by us on October 16th, written by Justin Dung, which was, quote, "I certainly felt that what I had done in the CFL or the experience that I had in the CFL was not valued. I was treated as the young guy, even though I was older than some of those players that had been drafted. That experience of leading locker rooms, being a captain in a professional league, never carried any weight. I didn't feel like that was given any credence. I feel like there was certainly things that I thought they'd have more respect for, the league and the players that come out of it. There's a ton of talent up here. I certainly felt like there was aspects of it that going into it, I believed in or leaned into a little bit too much, close quote. So I'm not saying it's 100% apples to apples comparison. This is Nathan Rourke coming back from the NFL, and we're comparing it to a guy who won two Grey Cups like 10 years ago, and then we're putting that on top of Ryan Dinwiddie, who's had a lot of success as of late. I think the Grey Cups matter a little bit, but I don't think that the NFL is like breaking down the door being like, we all got to hire this head coach. He's won two Grey Cups in the last 3 years. Like, that's amazing. So I maybe I'm in the middle between you two guys.
I think we're balanced.
The only thing that, or the thing that I found most interesting about this entire conversation with Dinwiddie was actually not the NFL stuff, because I've always thought that his path was more through the NCAA route, potentially back at Boise State, if that head coaching job opened. I know he'd been associated with it in the past, that could have been his stepping stone to that level. But he seemed to dismiss that outright, talking about the current situation in college football and how complex it is, shutting that door. I thought that was really interesting, because if he didn't get the traction in the NFL, he would have cachet, particularly at his alma mater at Boise. I thought that could have been his workaround. Clearly, he's not considering that at this point.
Stay warm and save every day. All in the Kroger app.
Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The BC Lions have off-season bonuses coming up for some key pending free agent receivers. Who do you see sticking around?
Well, it's going to be an interesting question, and a lot of it's in flux because of the contract situation around Justin McKinnis, who we all know led the CFL in receiving yards last year as a Canadian and is up for a significant pay raise. Now, Ryan Rigmaiden told you, Dunk, last week that he is close to a deal with Justin McKinnis. He seemed optimistic that they'll be able to get him re-signed. And if that happens, that's going to mean some serious choices for some other guys, namely Alexander Hollins, Keon Hatcher, and Javon Katoy, all of whom are going to earn either just north of or around that $200,000 mark next season if healthy, and all of whom have significant bonuses due before or on February 7th, before the opening of free agency. I don't think, realistically, assuming that McKinnis' deal puts him in the $200,000 range and above that, which I think is the expectation, that you can have four guys in your receiving core who are all earning that type of money. And certainly the performances of those players last year don't really merit it. They've all been exceptional players in the past. They all took a step back last season. We've talked endlessly about Alexander Holland's drop problems. It should be noted Ryan Rigman also said he had issues with his knees, and both of those have been scoped. Keon Hatcher came back from that Achilles tear, didn't quite look like the same player. Is he going to be able to rebound at over 30 years of age? And then Javon Katoy really struggled with his health. And you're talking about paying a guy just under $200,000 when he had 400 receiving yards last year. If you're going to do that, and I know there's a premium paid for contributing Canadians, but he's got to be a guy who's more involved in the offense if you're going to bring him back. So I don't know where they're going to end up. Me personally, I would probably say goodbye to Katoy and try and renegotiate Hollins at this stage. But they are considering all options, and Ryan Rigmaiden was very frank that they were trying to restructure these guys, and they were having trade talks with other teams to try and free up cap space because they are going to need it.
To me, the major factor in this decision comes down to what's the number that Justin McKinnis gets. I would imagine it's going to be over $200,000 and potentially well over $200,000 because, as JC alluded to, he carries that national passport, the Canadian passport, and he led the CFL in receiving last year. So I think that is going to be the major determining factor in this, along with, as JC laid out, the health of these receivers, where they're at in their recovery, and where the Lions believe they can get to. Can Keon Hatcher get back to that form that we saw before that devastating Achilles injury? Can Alex Hollins get back to that game-breaking, over-the-top kind of receiver that we have seen flashes from him, especially in the first six games during the 2024 season? But to me, a lot of this comes down to that number with Justin McInnes. And even in saying that, I kind of think that in one way or another, some of these guys are going to have to take a pay cut, and those roster bonuses in the offseason are there for the benefit of the player and the agent, but also the team as well, so that there can be a decision made.
I thought, first of all, JC did a great job with this article and should be commended. I don't think anyone else is doing this kind of reporting, which is pretty awesome. I also thought Justin nailed the nail on the head here when it comes to setting the receiver market, right? Eugene Lewis. I've got our Three Down Nation article up, by the way, right now. Top 15 highest paid receivers for the 2024 season. Eugene Lewis, $320K. He's a pending free agent. Kenny Lawler, $285, pending free agent. Dalton Schoen, $230, pending free agent. Nick Dembski, $225, not a pending free agent, but has the same agent as Justin McInnes. Alexander Hollins, $235, not going to see that money, right? Tim White, $235, pending free agent. Curley Gittens Jr.
No, Tim White's under contract.
Tim White's
under contract. He is under contract. Okay, fair enough. So he'll probably see that money. Fair enough.
But we know, as Ed Hervey said, that was an organizational decision. I think it should be noted, Justin McInnes' agent and Nick Dembski's as well, Rob Fry, who knows the market because, as you mentioned, helped set it with Dembski there for a Canadian receiver. But what Justin McInnes did is way and above what Nick Dembski has done from a production standpoint, at least.
Right. So if I'm Rob Fry, I'm saying, well, like, the negotiation starts with what, like I'm not entertaining anything under what Nick Dembski's getting, right? Because Justin McInnes had a monster season, and is younger than Nick Dembski, is bigger than Nick Dembski. But my point is, and what I think Justin was absolutely correct about, is Justin McInnes is probably going to be the highest paid receiver in the CFL in 2025. He led the league in receiving last year, and he's got the Canadian passport, right? Which is obviously an advantage and adds to his value. So I do think that there is some pressure, not only on the Lions, but also on McInnes and his camp to say, okay, where's the benchmark going to set? Because if you're Eugene Lewis, if you're Kenny Lawler, if you're Dalton Schoen, or if you are one of those teams hoping to land one of those receivers, this will set the benchmark for where that is. And I also thought, by the way, I gave Ryan Dinwiddie props. I will also give Ryan Rigmaiden props. I thought he was very forthcoming and candid in his answers regarding JC's well-done questions about his receiver situation. And obviously, we'll see how Hatcher's deal potentially fits into this, what happens with Javon Katoy. But I think that McInnes will set that benchmark for the receiver spot, which I think we all agree is going to be lower in 2025 than it was in 2024 after the position kind of started to spiral as of 2022 when Kenny Lawler signed a $300,000 contract with the Edmonton Elks. So this is the negotiation to me to watch right now. Justin McInnes and the BC Lions, because where that money comes in will allow a bunch of dominoes to fall behind it.
Yeah, and if it gets set at a reasonable amount, that gives the Lions a lot of leverage if they're going to ask these other receivers to renegotiate, because they can say, hey, look at what we just gave McInnes. He was probably worth way more than that a few years ago. The market has reset. Yeah, if you don't play ball and we release you, you could end up making less because there's going to be other spots occupied by other guys and the market has changed. So take a little pay cut and stay here for that security that could potentially give them some leverage to play with those guys. The other thing with McInnes that I think is worth discussion, and I have not spoken to Justin McInnes since his year-end press conferences, and I don't know what's currently going through his mind, But when we did speak to him at the end of the season, and we talked about his contract status and the fact that he was probably due a massive raise, he seemed to indicate that money was not necessarily the number one thing on his mind, that he liked being in BC and his family was there, and it was important for him to create some sort of stability there. Now, I know Rob Fry knows the market as well as anybody, and Justin McKinnis has sort of an obligation to his peers to push the monetary aspect to make sure that he doesn't set the market at a point that hurts other players. But is it possible that he takes slightly less than maybe he would be worth elsewhere to stay in BC, and that affects the market as well? I believe that could be a contributing factor to where all these receiver numbers end up landing.
Guys, to me, this is a simple decision. Pay Justin McKinnis, rework Javon Katoy's contract because he had a good rapport with Nathan Rourke and I think can still be a mismatch in this league. And to be quite honest, go find two American receivers to replace Alex Hollins and Keon Hatcher if they don't want to take drastic pay cuts. Like, I hate to be harsh about it, but let's put ourselves in Ryan Rigmaiden's chair and think about it this way. We've seen other teams, and we've talked about this recently on the podcast, find young, talented American receivers. Ontario Wilson with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers last year, now with the New York Jets. Keyhon Johnson, formerly in the NFL, with the Saskatchewan Roughriders. You can go on and on down the list. And that, to me, is a position that you should be able to go out and find at least one contributor, if not more. So that, you know, as this conversation has gone along, has become clear to me. Pay the Canadians. I still think Katoy has some upside. And if Hatcher and Hollins don't want to take a cut, we'll see you later. Open up space to protect Nathan Rourke more or to supplement your defense.
Yeah, an interesting thing that Rigmaiden also mentioned is he said, well, we all know that Buck Pierce's offense is all about running the ball. I'm paraphrasing there, obviously, but if you're Buck Pierce and you are going to prioritize running the ball, you just brought in James Butler. You know, I think their offensive line needs an upgrade. Wouldn't surprise me if they went American at one of those guard spots. But if you're going to run the ball, like, does it really make a ton of sense if you've already got arguably the best quarterback in the league to say, oh, and we're going to pay four different receivers $200,000? Like, no, the answer is no, it doesn't at all. And to Justin's point about Javon Katoy, he's arguably as like an extra fullback. He's big enough that he can really help in the run game.
Tight end.
So exactly right. He is a bit of a unicorn to that extent. And David Mackey, by the way, at fullback is also, I think, brilliant in that role. He's a pending free agent. So if you are the Lions, I do think that it would make more sense if Buck Pierce is going to try to bring kind of the ground and pound style of offense that he ran in Winnipeg to the West Coast. I think it would make sense to say, well, let's invest our money in David Mackey. Let's invest our money in Javon Katoy. We maybe don't need to spend a lot of money on these American receivers, knowing full well that if we scheme them open, Nathan Rourke should be able to hit guys who are on cheaper deals.
What if you're BC yeah. two sitting there going, okay, we're going to sign Justin McKinnis. Let's say it's for $250. Okay. That seems like probably fair value. Could end up between that $225 Nick Dembski mark, $250 perhaps more, but let's just say $250 is a number. And you're going, okay, rework Javon Katoy. That makes sense for the reasons Hodge just laid out. Let's get rid of Keon Hatcher and Alexander Hollins and talk to Kenny Lawler in the free agent window, who we know, who Ryan Rigmaiden has a history with. And oh, by the way, so does Buck Pierce.
Like, of course.
That would make some sense too, right? You clear up all that cap space at receiver. You alleviate the injury concerns. Yes, I know Lawler did have that issue with, what was it, his wrist, Hodge?
I know it was a fractured arm. I don't remember where in the arm it was.
O'Shea will never tell us. So let's say arm injury. Like, throw some money at him, and then you still would have money to perhaps supplement the offensive line or, like I said, on defense before. Like, the more we talk this through, it's clear to me, at least, what Rigmaiden could be thinking, although we are not him. We are speculating.
Yeah, to me, the biggest loss if you cut those two American receivers. Alexander Hollins, I think, is an exceptional talent, or can be when his mind is right, but he's a little bit, let's say, mercurial, right? He skews back and forth. He got in his own head. I think you can afford to lose him as the result of that. Keon Hatcher, as much as he was not the player that we were used to seeing last year, I think he is more the spiritual leader of that receiver room. I think he is the guy that people look to in that group. And I think he came back too early from that Achilles. And I don't necessarily think that we saw the player that he could return to. Even though he's at 30, you're never quite sure if those guys are going to bounce back. I would give it another year with him because I think he is one of the best receivers in the league, one of the most consistent receivers in the league when healthy, but almost to his own fault, he tried to help the team by rushing back, and he just wasn't there when he came back. Because let's not forget, he tore that Achilles in the West semifinal the year before, and he only missed 6 weeks of the season. That is a ridiculous turnaround for an injury that takes some people a full calendar year to recover from. I think we haven't seen the best of him yet, and I'm a little bit tentative docking him for that performance. Wilfrid Laurier University quarterback Taylor Algersma has been ripping it up on the U.S. College All-Star Circuit, garnering 8 NFL interviews over the past 2 weekends. He's at number 20 on the CFL's Winter Scouting Bureau rankings. How rare is this type of attention for a Canadian university QB?
This is, to steal a term, and I don't even know if this is going to make sense, but sometimes that's the case with Michael Pinball Clemens, omni-rare. Hodge, is that even a word?
Everything's a word if you try hard enough, except for drug, JC.
Man, you don't need to be on drugs to see that Taylor Algersma is an elite talent. Salivate over this dude. Get out your popcorn, whether you got the munchies or not, because this kid is showing through the first part of the draft process that he's the real deal. You want to know how rare it is that a Canadian quarterback gets NFL attention? The only Canadian university quarterback, I should specify, sorry, Canadian university quarterback to be selected in the NFL draft, Dan Faraday from the University of Toronto, back when the draft was too many rounds too long, was selected in the 12th round by the Cincinnati Bengals, okay? In 1982. Yes, my man. We got to go back a long time before even I was born, you young bucks, okay? So that's how rare this is. And this isn't just, I would say, fake NFL interest, okay? Michael Falds told me he has fielded calls from between 5 and 10 NFL teams before Algersma even went to the College Gridiron Showcase and the subsequent Tropical Bowl, where he interviewed with these 8 NFL teams. There is real interest here, and I've even talked to scouts, especially in the CFL, who have said, and in the United States as well, that if you swapped these players without the name recognition, Taylor Algersma and Curtis Rourke, I almost said Nathan, Taylor Algersma and Curtis Rourke, would you have known a difference between them playing at Wilfrid Laurier and Indiana with the Hoosiers? Now, I'm not saying that Algersma could have done what Rourke did with the Hoosiers, nor am I saying could Rourke have done that with the Wilfrid Laurier Golden Hawks having a heck right and worthy season and leading them to the Vanier Cup. But when you start to think about it that way, you have to realize the elite arm talent that JC can speak to, because he finally saw it for the first time, heard that ball whistling, that sweet whistle off his hands down in Texas, that this kid has legit tools, okay? That's why he deserves to be talked about, and he is rare. So, Canadian football fans, American football fans, stand up and pay attention to this kid, because I think that he has a rare package that could do something that potentially has never been done for a Canadian quarterback coming from a Canadian university.
I think your point is well taken, Justin, and it's something that's worth exploring and something that I have been mulling in my own mind as well. And that is, what truly is the difference between Curtis Rourke and Taylor Algersma? We've got Curtis Rourke at number 1 on the scouting bureau. We've been talking about him all year. And then Elgersma jumps on to number 20 on this list in this latest ranking. Is there really a 18-spot gap between the two? Is it a chasm? Is it a sliver? And I think if you really look at things, both Ontario-born quarterbacks, they're both 6'5", around 215. They basically got the same build. Both incredible talents. I think Rourke is probably a little bit of a better processor right now. I think Elgersma probably has a little bit more arm strength at this stage. But when you look at the path that Rourke took, when he was winning the MVP of the MAC, his coaches at Ohio came out and said, if his brother hadn't already been on the team because he had gone through the JUCO ranks and gone to a prep school in Alabama, all things that Curtis didn't do, he stayed at home in Oakville. We would have never offered him a scholarship. We would have never recruited him. We would have never brought him on the team. We would not have even looked at him if we didn't already have his brother. It was essentially a favor to Nathan. Given that context and what he has done with that, let's call it a lucky break or a relationship or those circumstances, Taylor Elgersma didn't have that opportunity. In fact, he didn't start playing football until he was in the 10th grade. He was a hockey defenseman before that, a big bruiser like Dion Phaneuf. Got 2 years, and then his senior year, when he might have had the opportunity to potentially start looking at U.S. opportunities, was COVID, and he couldn't do that. He did not have the opportunity to find that lucky break, and that's how he ends up at Laurier, where he essentially seized those reins and became the player he is today. If you reverse those two paths, if it's Taylor Elgersma who gets the lucky break and ends up at Ohio and gets a chance to sit in that D1 program for a couple years and eventually win the starting job, I think the narrative around these two players is entirely different. So, do I think Curtis Rourke is a little bit more pro-ready right now? Yes, absolutely. He has had, you know, a little bit more access to coaching resources. He's played more games because they play more games south of the border, and those reps matter in terms of a professional quarterback. And I certainly think from an NFL perspective, he's played the American game, and therefore that's going to help him. Or Taylor Elgersma, that'll be his biggest limitation if he gets a UDFA offer or a rookie minicamp offer and he has to go in there, is there may not be a bunch of patience for him to learn, unfortunately. So all those things are in Rourke's favor. But in terms of the pure talent and where their ceiling is at, I think these are both first-round CFL quarterbacks. I think they are both guys who can start at the professional level, and we'll be hearing Taylor Elgersma's name for a long time.
The difference for the ranking purposes has to do with level of competition. And yes, I'm biased towards Canadians in a way, but I would argue the perception of the level of competition. There's no doubt that the NCAA is better, but just because you played U Sports football does not mean that you can't compete at that level. And the level I'm talking about is the National Football League. And it's a little different situation. But guys like Tavius Robinson, who went from the University of Guelph to Ole Miss, you know, he got that competition level in the SEC to become a draft pick with the Baltimore Ravens and is playing meaningful reps on defense for them. Dean Leonard, we saw, made an unbelievable interception in the NFL playoffs, was at the University of Calgary, went the very same route to Ole Miss, got that level of competition stamp, we'll call it, and is in the NFL. So that's where Elgersma admittedly is behind the sticks, so to speak, is that he hasn't had that stamp for his level of competition quite yet. But it's not to say that there haven't been players from U Sports football, look as recently as last year, that have been able to make the jump from Canadian university football into the NFL. Theo Benedet, famously the Canadian Eagle with the Chicago Bears, an offensive lineman, and then Gio Manu, having the Detroit and Motor City Lions and Dan Campbell trade up in the draft to select him higher and put him on that roster there. There are a bunch of other examples that are documented at 3downnation.com over the years of guys that have come through the university level and went right to the NFL. Laurent Duvernay-Tardif is the prime candidate for that, going from little McGill University in terms of a football school to the Kansas City Chiefs blocking for Patrick Mahomes and winning a Super Bowl. Okay, so it's doable, but the reason that this deserves attention throughout the draft process is because it's rare for a Canadian university quarterback to even have NFL teams spend their time interviewing him, doing background research on him, let alone potentially, and we'll see how the process plays out, selecting him at the back end of the draft, signing UDFA contract, or giving him a rookie minicamp invite. So still important parts of the process to play out. But Taylor Elgersma is a name that you need to know and follow as a Canadian football fan.
And the last thing I'll say on this topic, if there's anybody out there who's going, well, we've had this conversation the last couple years with guys like Michael O'Connor and Trey Ford in terms of Canadian university quarterbacks trying to make a name for themselves, breaking into the CFL, potentially getting NFL interest. This is different. I got to watch Michael O'Connor for his entire career at UBC. I was there the entire time. I watched Elgersma 2 weekends ago down in Texas. He's a better talent right now. He's more polished than Michael O'Connor was, despite the fact that Michael O'Connor was one of the top-ranked recruits in the United States and spent a season at Penn State University. I think Elgersma is a better prospect right now. And when he went through that process, O'Connor didn't go to these sorts of games. And ultimately, when he had his pro day at UBC, I think one, maybe two teams showed up for it. Right? There wasn't a ton of attention. He did ultimately get a rookie minicamp invite, I believe, to the Seahawks, but that was it. We go a couple years into the future with Trey Ford, a guy who was an absolute freak athlete, still is. We've seen what he's done in the CFL. I was there when he went to the same event that Elgersma went to, the College Gridiron Showcase. At that time, the event was like a full 4 or 5 days long versus what it is now, which is essentially 2 days with the interviews. Over that entire time span, and Ford looked good. He showed his feet. He looked good at that event. He got a grand total of 0 interviews. Taylor Elgersma got 4 then and 4 the next weekend. Teams don't have to interview these guys. Frankly, most U Sports prospects don't get a look. Even guys like the Ford brothers, who are special. Tyrell Ford signed an NFL contract the very next year. He was at that event too. He did not get a single NFL interview. Nobody even talked to him. Taylor Elgersma goes there and he gets significant interest. He's got people across the event talking about him. This is real. This is different. I think he is, as a pure passer, already far ahead of where Ford was at this stage.
Mr. Hodge?
I concur.
Keep it locked to 3downnation.com for all the latest on Taylor Elgersma and the Canadian prospects as we go into draft season more and more, the process, the combine, the drafts on both sides of the border. The CFLPA released a statement strongly protesting the league's recent 2-game suspension for veteran defensive back Lucchez Purifoy. What's your take on the situation?
This is messy, boys. This is a mess. M-E-S-S-Y. Like, the way that this has been drug out, right, JC?
Into
the public sphere.
That's a funny pun in this circumstance.
I didn't even think about it that way, but yeah, I'll take the retrospective pun. It's messy. It's messy. Basically what happened, I mean, and let's acknowledge this, Purifoy, 9-year CFL veteran, has been around forever, tested positive for amphetamine. Amphetamine is an active ingredient in the brand name Adderall. Now, the CFL sent out a release on Friday, mere hours after Purifoy was released by the Elks. He was a pending free agent, but I think it's pretty obvious that the Elks cut him because they knew the suspension was coming down the pipeline because he tested positive for the substance, which is commonly prescribed to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, better known as ADHD. I believe that players can file what are called therapeutic use exemptions, aka TUEs, to take prescription medication that may contain certain ingredients that are technically not permitted under the CFL-CFLPA joint drug policy as outlined in the collective bargaining agreement. That being said, Purifoy did not do that, it would seem. Teams can still file what is called an emergency TUE, which will basically, after the fact, allow for the suspension to retroactively be reversed and never even announced. Theoretically, this happens every year where a player tests positive for something. They go, whoa, I'm taking this prescription. I had no idea it contained a banned substance. That's why I didn't complete the paperwork. And teams can help them out. And the league goes, okay, yeah, this makes sense. A doctor has said you legitimately have, you know, X, Y, or Z, and it makes sense that you're taking A, B, or C. All good, no issues, you're not a cheater. The PA is claiming that the Elks were instructed by the CFL not to file an emergency TUE, but instead file what is called a standard TUE, the difference being that a standard TUE does not allow for the suspension to be reversed, unlike an emergency TUE. I asked the league for comment, and I was provided the following statement, quote, in consideration of the complete timeline of events and the full set of facts, Mr. Purifoy has irrefutably violated the joint CFL-CFLPA drug policy. The Players Association has decided not to grieve the suspension, close quote. I also asked the Elks for comment, and they declined to provide one. So theoretically, the Elks could have said, well, it is completely untrue that the league instructed us to not file an emergency TUE on behalf of Mr. Purifoy. That is not at all accurate. They didn't do that. They didn't confirm it was the case, but they did decide not to argue against it. The interesting part here is that Purifoy was one of three player reps with the CFLPA this past season, alongside Scott Hutter and Boris Beattie. And I think that that has ruffled the feathers of the PA a little bit. Obviously, the PA wants to fight on behalf of all of their membership, right, and advocate for every single CFL player, or at least those who are paying dues as veterans. They didn't like this. Part of their statement, and they released a long statement, which can be found in full on 3downnation.com, but the part of the quote that really stood out to me was, quote, this harsh treatment of a union representative raises significant concerns about fairness and respect within the league. The CFLPA stands firmly with Lucchese, Purifoy, and all its members advocating for fairness, transparency, and policies that prioritize player well-being and rehabilitation over punitive measures, close quote. However, something that I thought was interesting is that earlier this offseason, Sione Tehama, defensive lineman for the BC Lions, was suspended 2 games for testing positive for the same exact substance. We don't know what the name brand of what he's taking is, but it was also amphetamine, and the CFLPA did not publicly comment on his suspension. So I think from the league's perspective, they might be going, okay, well, these guys are just, you know, they're going above and beyond for their reps because those are the guys they care about most, and this is completely ridiculous that they're challenging this. From the PA's perspective, they're probably going, well, you know, this is the league is out to get one of our player reps, or they're out to get a guy who they don't want to be in the league. And frankly, I don't know where I fall on that spectrum. I think it's weird for the PA to not grieve a suspension, but publicly protest it. And I think it's odd for the Elks to not be more forthcoming. I also think it's interesting that there seems to be this double standard between Purifoy and between Tehama. So this is a weird story. I've done my best reporting on it. I would like to do more reporting on it, but it is a bizarre one, to say the least.
You've certainly done an excellent job, Hodge, at exposing all the facts and all the elements of this particular case that make it so odd and so messy. Right? There's so many different conflicting elements that have people feeling different ways. I've made some controversial statements in the past on the podcast in terms of my feelings about PEDs and
I forgot about that.
We're not going to rehash that.
Why did you bring that back up yourself?
Because I'm a sucker for pain, Doug. A sucker for pain. What I'm saying is, or my point is, regardless of all that, I have a difficult time even with the argument that, yes, they could have said for an emergency, whatever it's called.
TUE,
an emergency
therapeutic
TUE
use
versus,
exemption.
Instead of a standard, and maybe that could have erased the suspension. Just the fact that Purifoy was taking this without going through the proper channels first, as a guy who should know better as a 9-year vet and a union rep who is involved in administering and telling other players about these types of policies, like, he should have known better. And I'm not saying that he wasn't, you know, taking it for medical reasons, but that sort of mistake, that sort of overlooking of that type of policy, to me, I don't have a great deal of sympathy for it, because ultimately there are ways he could have prevented deaths with actions that he should have known about as a union rep and a vet in this league, and he didn't until after it came up in a positive test. So this could have been nipped in the bud before it ever happened. He could have been flagged well in advance. He could have gone through the correct channels. It appears that he didn't in this case, and he waited for the poo-poo to hit the fan before doing anything. And for me, I don't have a great deal of sympathy for that.
I just wish, fellas, that the CFL and the Players Association could have dealt with this behind the scenes so that you don't have a suspension that comes out and then the Players Association, as they should do, comes out and condemns it. And then now there's going to be this public debate and a back and forth, presumably, until there's a resolution here. Like, this is where I think the CFL needs to treat the players more like partners in this league for many other various reasons. But in this instance, because it's become messy, as Hodge described, and I think that's a great word for it, and I just wish the CFL would do that instead of, you know, what seems like they like to do in the past, bullying the players. Like, why not resolve this behind the scenes? There have been other things that haven't made its way out into the public. Why did this happen this way with something that seems possible to have a logical decision made that all parties agree on?
It's almost time for Hodge's Heritage Moment, but first I want to commend JC for using the word poo-poo on the podcast.
Well, I couldn't say the word that I was actually thinking.
After your earlier faux pas, I think the word poo-poo has redeemed you.
Well, we're talking about words. Can we just say Elgrisma? Elgrisma.
Elgrisma is not a word. That is a proper noun.
Taylor Elgrisma.
Elgrisma. I don't know how I'm saying it differently.
You say Elgrisma. Dunk says Elgrisma. Which he
claims everybody
the
says
right
Elgrisma. It's like Hodges hang up with Kolaris.
I'm that was be good. Honest. Every time everyone says two names with different pronunciations, they sound exactly the same to me.
Then you,
I can't hear a difference.
Elgrisma, Elgrisma.
Then maybe you need some Adderall.
Kolaris.
You're lengthening one of the syllables in that case. So
yeah,
yes, I can hear the difference there. But no, I don't. I say Elgrisma.
I think
that was on point.
Okay. If you can't hear the difference between things, JC, maybe you need some Adderall. That would help.
I have been prescribed it in the past.
Oh, okay. There we go. So you're halfway there.
Don't poo-poo him for it.
Yes. Yes. Love it. On this day in 1989, Terry Greer won Super Bowl 23 as a member of the San Francisco 49ers. I'll take listeners behind the scenes. I forgot to write out the Super Bowl 23 as numbers, and I'm so proud of myself for getting
well
one.
Done.
I'm pretty
I was just
sure
say Roman
it's the
numerals.
Right Roman numeral. I'm like 90% sure. I'm going to give myself a big old pat on the back. I'm not poo-pooing myself at all. The Memphis native spent 6 seasons with the Argonauts from 1980 to 1985, during which he recorded one of 3 2,000-yard receiving seasons in CFL history. The Alabama State product was the first player ever to win a Grey Cup and Super Bowl and was inducted into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame in 2019. Dunk, you're the only one on this podcast who might be old enough to remember Greer's playing career. Do you remember how good he was?
I mean, when he was winning Grey Cups and Super Bowls, first of all, The Grey Cup, I wasn't even alive yet. I was born in 1986. The Super Bowls, I would have been 3 and 4, 1989, 1990. But nonetheless, I think this dude is one of the underrated players in CFL history, considering, as you said, he has one of the three 2,000-yard receiving seasons that the league's ever seen. You know, I feel like Alan Pitts gets talked about a lot and some various other receivers. But Greer was nice, man. Like, this guy was smooth out there from what I've seen on some of the old highlights and from what I've heard from former teammates. So it's great that we're giving him some praise.
I know that his career was short, just 5 or 6 years in the CFL. But how did it take until 2019 for this guy to get in the Hall of Fame? That's one of my beefs with the Canadian Football Hall of Fame, is how long it takes them to recognize guys who had shorter CFL careers.
Take it up with the fogies.
Exceptional, right? Like, we put in a lot of guys who had really long CFL careers who were not that great at their peak. We absolutely need to do a better job of highlighting the guys who were actually dominant in their prime in this league, even if they only played for a handful of seasons.
I'm going to put you guys to the test really quick. Terry Greer had the first 2,000-yard season, 203,000 yards in 1983. Do you know the other two players?
203,000 yards?
2,003 yards. Three more yards than 2,000. Apologies if I misspoke. Do you know the other two receivers? JC, stop Googling. I can see you Googling. Stop Googling.
Bro, what are you Googling for? Come on, man.
Well,
one
is
Alan
Pitts, out.
Obviously.
Alan
and
Pitts
I believe
is correct.
The other has a nickname that rhymes with Pookie.
Yes, you are
Daryl
correct.
Daryl Mookie Mitchell. JC, get off your Google machine, bro. Don't come at me with this fake knowledge you claim to have.
Okay, who's number four, Doug? Tell me who's number four now that I've got the fake knowledge.
For what?
In single season receiving yards. He didn't get 2,000, but he's just behind it.
Terry Vaughn?
Nope.
Damn.
I'll give you a hint. It happened in the year 1956. This guy was putting up those numbers in 56.
I've had it in front of me this whole time, so I don't want to say.
I got the player in my mind, but I can't think of the name. I can see his face. Who is it?
Hal Patterson. He's got to be the most underrated player in CFL history. That guy was like decades ahead of his time in terms of catching the football.
It is crazy how Sam Echeverry, I believe, was the quarterback at the time,
yeah,
was slinging the rock back in the 1950s when a lot of people didn't even want to throw the rock. By the way, since 2000, the person who has come closest to 2,000 yards receiving in a single season is Milt Stegall, who caught passes for 1,896 yards in 2002. So it's been a long time since somebody really got close. Who knows? Maybe we'll see it at some point in the future.
Let's go to the three-minute drill. The Calgary Stampeders have signed American running back Dedrick Mills to a one-year contract extension. Is that a smart move for the Stamps?
I think it is. I like Mills. I think a better move might be bringing back Kadeem Carey. But given the recent beef that has existed, I don't know if it's so much Dave Dickinson to Kadeem Carey as much as just one way from Kadeem Carey to Dave Dickinson. I don't think that reunion is going to be in the cards. Two Canadian players won this year's national championship game with the Ohio State Buckeyes. Is that a big deal, JC?
It is a big deal. Maxence LeBlanc, the tight end, and Anthony Venery, the punter. Neither of them were significant players for Ohio State this year, but only 10 Canadians have now won a national championship since there's been an actual national championship game in the NCAA. And this is the first time that multiple Canadians have won it in the same year since 2001, when there were four Canadians on what some people argue is the greatest college football team of all time, the 2001 Miami Hurricanes. Montreal Alouettes GM Danny Maciocha believes Sean Lemon should be reinstated after missing most of the 2024 season due to a gambling suspension. Do you think he will be?
I think there's a possibility. A lot of that's going to depend on whoever the new commissioner is and whenever they get into place, because Randy Ambrosi seems to be on a crusade about this, but personally, I think he should be. If you look at other leagues, specifically the NFL and the gambling suspensions that have happened there, one season, and it wasn't quite a full one because he appealed and played a little bit, but I think in this instance, the punishment has way outdone the crime, so to speak. So I would be letting Sean Lemon play again. And you know, fellas, I don't want to open a whole can of worms, as famously quoted in the lawsuit by John Murphy, but people will point out that, well, Chad Kelly only got 9 games and Sean Lemon bet $100 on a game and he got the majority of an entire season. So I'll let those facts speak for themselves. People can debate it, but I do think he should be let back in. The Montreal Alouettes signed defensive lineman Trayvon Mason following his release from the Hamilton Tiger Cats. Can Mason make an impact there?
I remember Mason being extremely disruptive during the preseason for Hamilton. Now, he only played 10 games during the regular season. I don't think it was super disruptive, but he did look to me like a big kind of game-wrecking defensive tackle. So I would very much like to see him get an opportunity in Montreal, especially considering how many good D linemen that they have there. I think he could be an excellent part of that rotation. The Ottawa Redblacks seem keen on deploying William Stanback and Devontae Williams from the backfield. Considering offensive coordinator Tommy Condell is pretty well known as a guy who doesn't like to run the ball, do you believe them?
I don't. I don't think they'll find a way to keep two American backs on the roster. I just don't think it's worthwhile in the CFL, particularly when you're not going to commit to running the football as Tommy Condell has proven in his CFL career. To me, the signing of William Stanback meant that they're not 100% confident that Devontae Williams can come back to full health. And now they've got a Canadian who can back up in Daniel Agababoye on the roster. I think that'll be the combination, Stanback and Agababoye, going into next year. Andrew Harris told the media that he wants to be a CFL head coach or general manager one day. Do you think he'll succeed in that goal?
It's possible, but let's see how he does as a running back coach with the Riders first. And I think to his credit, that's what he's focused on, is the here and now. Three Down Nation contributor Santino Filoso spoke with OSEG's Mark Gowdy about the renovations coming to TD Place Stadium in Ottawa, part of Lansdowne 2.0. What were your takeaways, Mr. Hodge?
It'll be interesting to see how the team plays with a reduced capacity in 2028, 2029. We don't know what the capacity is going to be, but obviously that will impact their crowds. The other thing that they have to get right, and I'm saying this on the podcast, is that apparently Scott Grant, who has been a photographer shooting CFL games for like 50 years, and all of his work is featured on Three Downs. So if you've looked at our pictures on our website, you know Scott Grant's work. When they reopened TD Place, apparently they had to cut back the roof on the north side of the stadium because it was like quite literally at risk of collapsing. And when they did that, they had to get rid of a ton of lighting at the stadium, which is why when games are played after dark in Ottawa, they look terrible on TV because there's just not enough light. So whatever you do here, apparently they're not building a new roof on the north side, which seems like a mistake to me. I'm not paying money to sit out in the rain like that. I feel like that would hurt ticket sales, but put some lighting. Make the game look good. After dark in Ottawa, it looks like trash, and it is not the fault of any of the production staff members or any photographer shooting the game. It is too dark. I was there for the rain game against Saskatchewan this past year. Watching that game, even in person, was hard sometimes. It is too dark. Get some lighting. The Toronto Argonauts have signed Calvin Turner Jr., who has experience at quarterback, running back, receiver, and defensive back. Which position is he going to play in the CFL?
Well, I think he's going to play receiver, but it should be noted, not only does he have experience at all those positions, he was an all-conference selection at each of those positions at one point or another in his college career. Talk about being versatile. I think that's going to help him try and scratch and claw his way on to the Argos roster. The Redblacks have signed starting safety Alonzo Adai to a contract extension. Does that work well for both sides?
I think it does. He's Canadian, physical, flies around, and I'll be curious to see how he does in this defense led by new coordinator William Fields. The BC Lions released American offensive lineman Kent Perkins this past week. Where could he end up?
Well, I was thinking maybe Winnipeg. From what I understand, right tackle Eric Lofton, who's a pending free agent, has yet to have any conversations with the Bombers about an extension. That being said, I haven't been able to get in touch with Perkins yet. The winter edition of the CFL Scouting Bureau rankings came out on Wednesday. JC, what's your top takeaway?
Well, I think this is a deep and loaded class of defensive linemen, 7 in the top 20, including some I still think are underrated, like number 13, Darian Newell. I think he's a lock to be a first-round pick. But it's not as strong along the offensive line. And I'm really going to be watching as we go through the combine process, guys. If anyone separates themselves from the pack, right now only 3 in the top 20, Eric Anderson from Western, people speak highly of him. Christopher Fontaine at UConn had a great season. And Samuel Carson, the former University of Calgary Dino, who finished his career at Louisiana Monroe. I'm not sure any of those guys are a generational type of talent. They're solid players. After that, it gets rather thin. We're going to see if anybody can step up into that upper echelon of offensive linemen in the next in the coming weeks and months. In a story you broke, Dunk, the Riders have re-signed offensive lineman Travion Tate. Is that a wise move?
I think it is for multiple reasons, but most importantly, the fact that I think you should expect him to be the leading candidate to replace Trevor Reed at left tackle, played that spot in the West Final and did pretty well there, even though he had spent the majority, if not all of his time with the Riders after he signed in August at right tackle. So Jeremy O'Day, Corey Mace both said from the winter meetings that they felt like they had somebody they were confident in. And I think the guy that's going to get that first shot is Tate. The CFL unveiled several key dates for 2025, including the legal tampering window opening on February 2nd and closing on February 9th, the CFL's Invitational Combine in Waterloo, Ontario on February 28th, the CFL Combine, national style, in Regina from March 21st to 23rd, the CFL Draft on April 29th, rookie camps opening on May 7th, and training camps, the full version, begin on May 11th. What are you most looking forward to, Hodge?
I will answer your question in 1 second. This has irked me for a while now. It bothers me deeply that the CFL Combine is an invitational event you have to be invited to participate. And the CFL's Invitational Combine is an event where anybody can show up and perform and you don't need an invitation. Can we please get these names changed to something that makes more sense? It used to be a regional combine followed by the combine. Invitational actually would make perfect sense for what is currently the CFL Combine. The CFL Invitational Combine is a terrible name for what is currently known as the CFL Invitational Combine, but I digressed. I'm not in charge of naming these events, though I feel like I could probably come up with a better answer than what is currently in place. The event to answer your question I'm most looking forward to is the CFL Combine, and that's because the three of us are going to be in Regina! Experience Regina! Bah, bah, bah. You guys know that song?
That was pretty good, yeah, I do.
I love that song. I unironically listened to it on YouTube. I did it the other day, and I'm excited. We already got our travel basically booked, ready to go. It's going to be great. Three Down Nation is going to have the three of us. I also know that Brandon McGuire is going to be around. I'm sure Joel Gaston will be around. They're both Regina natives. So 5 reporters with boots on the ground is pretty unheard of from a single publication in today's day and age. I'm excited to be there and bring all of our listeners, readers, subscribers, the goods. Canadian linebacker Bo Lacombe retired this past week after a 10-year career in the CFL. How will you remember him?
Well, I'd like to say that I'd remember him for being a most outstanding Canadian, or as a local guy who played just about every role possible during his time with the BC Lions, starting out as an outstanding special teamer to a role player to a starting linebacker to a versatile backup. But the reality is I'm going to remember him most for one play he made as a Montreal Alouette against the BC Lions when he came downhill from playing safety and knocked Shaq Murray-Lawrence into another universe with that hellacious, clean shoulder tackle. That play, I think, will live on in infamy for a long, long time. It may have actually knocked Shaq Murray Lawrence into the future to witness Bo Lacumbo's retirement before he was sucked back to reality.
Was it Shaq Murray Lawrence?
It was Shaq Murray Lawrence. Look it up.
I'm not positive that it was, but I'll trust your judgment.
I don't know if we can trust it. He didn't even know about Daryl Mookie Mitchell, bro. He did Google it. Like, his first instinct when you asked him the question was to start Googling.
I remember who it was. It was not Shaq Murray Lawrence.
Shaq Murray Lawrence?
No, it was not. It was not. It was... He retired not that long ago. Oh, this is going to drive me nuts.
Let's figure it out so we don't leave our listeners wondering.
Right now. You guys need to talk for 30 seconds. Wayne Moore. It was Wayne
Moore. Oh,
Wayne Moore.
I got my Canadians mixed up.
JC. Bro.
That's terrible.
I don't want to say it, but are we going to start calling you JC Fake News Abbott?
Come on, bro.
You said with conviction. Double and triple down on that it was Shaq Murray Lawrence and Wayne Moore. Those are two completely different body types, my man.
They're both Canadian running backs with longer hair. I don't know.
Bruh.
My apologies to Olympic bobsledder Shaq Murray Lawrence. Sincerely.
Well done.
From the bottom of my heart. Wayne Moore. Hey, he hit Wayne Moore so hard, he turned into Shaq Murray Lawrence.
Good save. Good save.
That does it for this episode of the Three Down Nation podcast. JC and myself are off next week, but we have a special edition for you. So don't you dare miss it. And Hodge, enjoy the time away from the pod and us goofballs causing your grief and making you frown.
I'm looking forward to it. Just while you're away, don't spread any fake news about Shaq Murray Lawrence, okay?
Deal.